Welcome back, everybody. My name is Kaz, and joining me today, the second skull, instead of Medibot like it usually is a special guest.
Yeah.
He is the world champion of Netrunner, who's written articles for Fantasy Flight Games about the game and just loves it to death. And he's going to tell us all about it. It's Jens Eriksson. Hello, Jens.
Hey. Those are all truthful statements, every single one of them. But yes,
Why don't you give us a general outline of what the game is and how it's played?
Okay, well,
start with the general.
So generally, it's a card game. It's a two-player card game, in fact. It is asymmetric card game, in that both sides aren't playing with the same deck. Not like the same deck, but the same card pool.
Okay, so as a trading card game, you have like your collection and you build a deck of a certain number of cards,
mm-hmm.
and your opponent also does the same, and
mm-hmm.
you shuffle up and play.
Yeah, it's, I guess, a little bit of backstory on Netrunner. It's a card game that was made by Richard Garfield as his third card game? I want to say third after Magic the Gathering, as I'm sure some people listening are familiar with, maybe. And a couple others. But in 1996, it ended up dying off as a game, but got picked back up about 3 years ago. Yeah. It's been going pretty strong ever since.
Yeah, so is it based on anything?
The original, I'm not certain about the original one, but the current iteration that Fantasy Flight has takes place in their Android universe, which has a couple other board games that exist in it, but not much
else.
Okay,
so it's all a universe just for the games?
Yes, there's no...
They don't have, like... This drawn from the comics, a D ampersand D product.
No, kind of no, nothing like that. They actually like to, it's kind of like generic future cyberpunkish land where they like to reference all sorts of other media as well. But it's...
Yeah, cyberpunk as a genre tends to have a little latitude with regard to callbacks and call forwards, I guess, even.
Yeah.
Like, hey, you know, here's something you might have seen in your life. What about the people of tomorrow? They would still have that.
Yeah, they not only that sort of thing, but they also call out other sci-fi genres, which I'm sure those will come up as I even explain the mechanics, because one of the factions, as it were, is a very blatant reference. But yeah.
Okay, so it's not like directly lifting from a mythos.
No,
it's not. It's on the tip of my tongue that
it's an
tabletop RPG. Shoot, I've
Shadow,
even played
Shadow
it.
Run.
Shadowrun. That's what it was called. It had "run" in the name, and I was trying to have it not have "run" in the name. So it's not just like Shadowrun, but in card form.
No, it's its own thing. Okay. I want to say that the original Netrunner did have a universe that it existed in, but I actually know very little about the original Netrunner outside of the fact that I've played with like a starter deck of it. So,
very cool. So, okay. So I'm playing a deck, you're playing a deck, and they're different.
That's correct. They cannot contain any of the same cards when you're playing the decks. In a game of Magic, you could play a red deck. You could play a mirror match, as it were, a deck against the exact same deck. But in Netrunner, the two sides are there's I guess two different sides to the game. There's the runner or the hacker, as it were. They're called the runner. They're like the flavor wise, they're the lone, you know, hero trying to steal. Yeah, the lone hero trying to steal.
Yes.
And then on the other side, you have the corporation, which is, know, this is the cyberpunk future. Everything is owned by major conglomerates.
Right. Everything is owned.
Yes. Hmm. So those two sides don't, while they have a couple, they share mechanics in the game, they don't share cards at all.
So every single card is a card or a B card.
Yes, they no card belongs to both sides. They actually have separate card backs, even.
Wow.
One side has blue and the other side has red.
Okay, well, that makes sense for if you're going to do an asynchronous game. Do they have different win conditions?
No, the main win condition of the game is the same for both sides. Both sides are attempting to score 7 agenda points. An agenda is a type of card that is contained in the corporation's deck. Either the corporation scores them through game mechanics, taking time to play them out, spend money to score them, or the runner just steals them flat out from your hand, from your grave, from your deck, from wherever. They're thieves. They're great.
Okay, can this score go up and down, or does it just go up?
It almost always only goes up. There are cards that use those points as a cost for powerful effects.
Okay.
But in general, in most use cases, yeah, it's just up. But that's like the shared win condition. You can also the corporation, for example, can lose by decking. If they begin their turn and have no cards left in their deck, they lose the game. The runner, however, does not have that loss condition.
Hmm.
Because the runner is never at any point in the game forced to draw a card. There's a lot of... There's some mechanics to that I'll get to. But the runner also has its own set of a couple different loss conditions. So.
Okay, so that's the basic setup.
Mm-hmm.
And the structure of the card pools and victory conditions.
Mm-hmm.
So how does play begin? Like starting the game.
Okay, so I guess it begins with having two decks on both sides. A deck on both sides. I guess as a rule, a person would want to have one of each side if they were going to play a full match, but isn't necessary for a game. Both sides start with a hand of 5 cards, 5 credits, which is a resource, but not the resource in the game.
Mm.
All cards have a credit cost associated with them to play. It's, I guess it's most similar to mana, but the way that you gain and spend credits is a lot more fluid. It's not as restricted as 1 land per turn, and then you can only play spells that cost 1 or accelerate up. I guess, how do I go on that?
So we have, it's turn 1, we have 5 cards and 5 credits.
Yep, the corporation always takes the first turn, and the idea is, as I mentioned, that each side is attempting to score 7 points. And these points only exist in the corporation's deck. They're a card type that they play. And there are deck-building rules on how many agenda points need to exist in a corporation player's deck based on their deck size. On average, a deck will contain 20 agenda points, which is enough to make it... You know, otherwise you would just play something like 12 points in your deck, and then you could get to a stalemate.
Mm.
So the biggest action to know, I guess, before the game begins is that the runner, as one of the runner's actions that they can take on the turn, is to make a run at for lack of a non-jargon term, a server, which is they either can try to look at the top card of your deck, try to look at a card from your hand, or try to look at your cards in your graveyard. And if they at any point find an agenda in those, they just steal them no cost and gain those points. So as the corporation, you're trying to stop them from being able to do that. You don't want to lose the game on turn one.
Okay, so if I'm the corporation and I'm starting and I have my loadout,
mm-hmm.
How do I make a play?
Okay, so I said that credits were a resource in the game, but they're not the resource. The resource in the game is a click or like an action that you can take on your turn. As the corporation, at the beginning of your turn, you draw a card, and then you have three actions or clicks available to you that you can use to do any multitude of things. You can use them to draw an additional card, you can use them to gain a credit, you can use them to play a card out of your hand. The runner also has the same restriction on number of actions they can take. They get four actions a turn, but they don't have the force to draw at the beginning, which gives them a bit more flexibility in their choices. So that's kind of the main limiting factor in the game. If you want to make credits to be able to play a card from your hand, you need to use these clicks to generate them, or use cards from your hand to generate them. And then use them on either, if you're the corporation, you have five different, let's see, operation, ice, agenda, upgrade, asset. Yeah, five different card types that, you know, you use your money to play throughout the game. But the biggest restriction is those clicks based on, you know, because your turn is over once you take three actions, or as the runner, your turn is over when you take four actions.
Okay. Can you choose to take no action as an action?
There is no action as an action. The closest to that would just be like taking a credit, because that's the most null action.
Yeah, like that doesn't affect the game state beyond like this number goes up one.
Okay. Yeah, it's just my amount of resources goes up by one. Great, that number is meaningless unless I'm spending it. So, yeah.
So is it completely fluid? Like you could flush it all into money, or just draw three cards,
yep,
or whatever else. Yeah,
yeah. You have no restriction if you're the runner and there's a specific card you're in this game state where there's only one card that matters to you, you can just draw four cards on your turn.
You understand how, as a player of collectible card games, this excites me a little bit.
Yeah, it's very interesting that one of the main rules of Magic, which is the idea of card advantage, really just kind of flies out the window in this game, because you can't really be down on cards in a game where you can just be, I'll draw four, you know? It your actions are your main, I guess, your kind of what you have to choose what you're doing.
Right, so like in a turn-based RPG or something, we have an action economy,
mm-hmm.
and if you can get an advantage that way, then that's pretty significant.
Yeah, that's one of the a number of the cards that have like a permanent effect in the game, either to move a little bit onto card types, either assets from the corporation or hardware and programs from the runner have like a, I guess resources as well from the runner, are like permanents that stay in play, and a number of them just kind of alter your action economy. Instead of having the ability to gain one credit for one click, you can gain two credits for one click. And that's a part of, that's a pretty big part of it.
Mm. Okay, well, let's talk about the different card types then.
Yeah, that's probably a good place to start. So on the corporation side, I've mentioned the agendas, which are the victory condition on both sides. Both sides want to score a number of agendas, 7 points in agendas. For the runner, all it takes is for them to look at access a single agenda. They can, on their turn, as well as being able to grab a credit or draw a card or play a card, they can choose to run on a server, which would let them access either the card that's in it, that's in play, or a card from the player's hand. The agendas are... Generally, they'll have a cost up in the upper right and a number of points in the middle left. In order to score an agenda, the corporation needs to play one of these cards out, like, into play in another, I guess, what's called a server. There's a lot of jargon in this game. It's it takes a bit to get used to. They actually have specific names for library, hand, and grave based on what side you're playing.
Jeez.
Yeah. So, like, that takes some getting used to. Like, your hand is HQ if you're playing the corp. Or R&D is your deck. So in order to score an agenda, you need to place it into play in a server, which is just like an in-play zone, and take that costs an action. Then you need to advance the card times equal to its cost in the upper right, which can be like 2 to 5. And that is just spending a credit to put a token on it. But, like, if you have an agenda that costs like 3 or 4 advancement to score, because you only have 3 actions in a turn, you can't possibly score it in one turn. So you have to leave it in play, vulnerable to the runner accessing and stealing and losing all your hard work.
Okay, so if you do place all the tokens on an agenda, then you get it.
Yes, you just...
And that's yours.
You get it. You get to score it. A lot of agendas, actually, every agenda has an ability either when scored or while scored or when stolen sometimes. Each of these agendas has some sort of ability relating back to your faction that you're playing. They're almost always only good for the corporation, if scored. So in order to defend those agendas and your hand, there's another card type called ICE, which is... What does that actually stand for? Intrusive countermeasure? Something countermeasure... It's another cyberpunk term that's used in other media. You use it to defend your servers, placing it in front of either the card you have in play or the card, your hand or deck or graveyard, and it acts as an obstacle for the runner to overcome.
Okay, so when you place ICE on your hand or library,
mm-hmm.
It's public? There's something there?
Yeah, it is. You place it face down in front of whatever it's defending, and you can place multiple pieces of ice in a kind of like a row, or I guess a column, in front of it. And then they would have to be, every time the runner would want to access that zone, they would have to get past each of them. And while they're face down, they have no effect. They cost nothing to place face down other than when you place the second or third or fourth on a larger column, it has like an additional cost of 1 credit, 2 credits. But the cost comes on that when you flip it face up. So that's hidden knowledge up until the runner attempts to make it past it. So let's say, for instance, you... On your turn as the corporation, you placed a piece of ice in front of your library. And the runner, on their turn, goes ahead and chooses to make a run at your library to access the top card. Now, trying to find agenda points. If there's multiple pieces of ice on a server, they would access each in succession from, like, farthest away to closest as they were placed, if you can... And then you, as the corporation, have the option to flip, to pay its cost to flip it face up. Once it's flipped face up, it stays face up, it's no knowledge, and you don't have to pay any more costs on it. But the runner, every time they go to bypass it, they're going to have to spend money credits continually every time they try to pass it. So it's like an investment on your end that becomes kind of a drain on the runner's resources, or sometimes it's just a hard stop. For instance, a piece of ice might just say, end the run. You know, okay, and then it ends that action, the runner gets kicked out, and then they're on to their next action. And ice also might not stop them from running, it might do detrimental effects to the runner, make them lose credits, for instance, make them lose actions, make them lose programs in play, make them lose cards from hand, etc. There's a lot of different effects that ice can have.
Hmm.
And the fact that it's face down and unknown is what kind of gives it its power. So those are, yeah, you have agendas, ice. Operations are effectively sorceries. That one's actually quite easy to go by.
Okay, so an operation, you pay a cost and it does something and then
it goes,
you shuffle it away?
It goes into your archives, your graveyard.
Yeah. The discard pile.
Yes, it goes into the used pile. So, for instance, one of the most common operations on the corporation side is a card called Hedge Fund. It costs 5 to play, and it gains you 9 credits. So it effectively gives you 4 credits for the action, which is, you know, 3 more than you would have gotten by just gaining a credit with the action. Other operations, you know, in that same manner, they can either, you know, they're sorceries. They can have any number of different effects, where either making your actions more lucrative to use or doing some sort of unique effect, getting rid of cards in play, getting rid of cards in your opponent's hand, etc. A lot of the same things that ice can do, but as a sorcery on your turn.
Okay, so that's agendas, ice, and operations.
Yep. There's 2 others. Assets, which are the corporation's permanent type. They go, much like agendas, they get installed in a server, and they'll have some sort of either permanent effect or effect while in play. A common one. Oh, I guess backing up a little bit, a server can only contain either 1 agenda or 1 asset.
Okay. How many servers can you have?
Infinite. As many as you want to make.
Okay.
So you can play out, but you can't. This is in upgrades are in the same way. They go in a remote server, but they don't have that restriction. So you can have any number of upgrades in a server with an asset or an agenda. They are a bit more uncommon card type, but they act as kind of like an augmentation to a server, if
okay.
that makes
can,
sense.
Can you have such a thing as a server without an either agenda or asset?
Yes, you can have it with just... when you play an agenda, or you play an asset, or you play an upgrade in a remote server, again, you play them just face down,
mm-hmm.
and then that costs you an action to play a card from your hand. And then you can pay the cost in the upper left to turn the card face up on assets and upgrades. Agendas, you have to keep face down until you put enough advancement counters on them such that you score them. But assets and upgrades, you can turn up at any time by paying their cost. They'll have... I guess on assets and upgrades. Assets and upgrades are actually very similar. The only difference between the two is that you can... There's only 2 differences between the two. The first being that you can have any number of upgrades in a server, whereas you can only have 1 asset or agenda in a server. And the second being that an upgrade can also be placed on either your hand, your library, or your graveyard to augment that in some way. And I guess, for instance, an upgrade might have the text, in order to run on this server, it costs the runner an additional action. Or in order to, in this server, once there's a successful run, discard 1 card from your opponent's hand. So they kind of augment the server that they're in. They also, assets and upgrades, have a little garbage can in the bottom right with a number in it, and that's its trash cost. At any point, if the runner accesses that card by, you know, if you place it in a remote server and they choose to run at it. They access it. They can pay the number in the bottom right to just destroy it.
Hmm.
So this works while it's in play, but it also works if it's in your hand or in your deck. So if the runner, you know, runs at your hand, accesses a card with a trash cost, they can trash it right there and then by paying whatever that cost is. So, for example, going by some of the more common cards, there's a card called Pad Campaign. It's an asset that costs 2 credits to res, flip face up.
Hmm.
Res is the term for that. And it has the text, at the beginning of your turn, gain 1 credit. So it's this kind of like economy piece that gives you a free credit every turn. And it costs 4 for the runner to trash if they access it. So if the runner doesn't want you gaining money every turn, they can spend 4 of their dollars to stop you from gaining that. Though you can also defend a remote server with ice just as you would be able to your hand or your grave or your deck. I think that's all 5. On the corporation side. The runner side has similarities, but not... I guess I could go over those as well, quick.
Yeah.
On the runner side, you have events, which are the exact same as operations. They're sorceries. They even have... I mentioned Hedge Fund was a card that cost 5 credits to gain 9. The runner has Sure Gamble, which costs 5 to gain 9. So that they have like it is the exact same card.
Okay, but there's a lot of mirror cards or functional.
There's only
reprints.
Yeah, there's only sense. I think there's only like 3 or 4 exact text cards like that, but it shows that they at least share, while they're playing different decks, they share the same resource in that sense. Mm-hmm. So there's events. We have programs, which are cards. There's 3 different types of permanents on the runner's side. There's programs, hardware, and resources. All 3 of those are cards that you pay a cost for, and they go into play. Resources and hardware act very similarly in that you pay the cost, they go into play, and that's it. There's no other kind of keeping them in mind with it, except for that a resource is easier for the corporation to get rid of than a hardware, and is generally a more common. There's a lot of different things that both card types can do. It's, thinking about it, they're actually very similar. And programs have a secondary cost of memory. Each runner starts the game with 4 like memory units of cards that they can have, of programs they can have in play. And in the top left hand corner, in addition to the credit cost of the card, there's also the memory cost. So
your hard drive space for this.
Yes. And you can, so you can play, if you have 2 programs in play that both cost 2 memory, you're at max. So you either need to play a piece of hardware that gives you additional memory, or you can play another program and overwrite a program that you have in play and just put it in your grave.
Okay. Now, do you I presume there's a lot of tokens and coins that you use, just physical objects that you use to
yes,
play the game?
Yes. I have sitting next to me, I've got the little Punch Out. Fantasy Flight games are kind of notorious for having a lot of small punch outs for different little tokens, and this game does use a lot of them, though I find it a lot easier to just use dice, because trying to determine how much money someone has by seeing a pile of small tokens sitting in front of them is a lot more difficult than seeing 13,
Yeah, okay, so you have your bundle of dice and your cards and different permanent types and events. And okay, so describe the action of a run, because it sounds like this is one of the primary operations or actions of the game.
Yeah, this is This is the, like, when you look at the rule book, everything else is described fairly simply, and then this has, like, a very large section on it. So the way a run works is that the runner, as one of their actions for the turn, they can, again, they can take a credit, they can draw a card, they can play a card from their hand, or they can run on any server that the corporation has. So they can run on the corporation's hand, they can run on the corporation's deck, they can run on the corporation's graveyard, or they can run on individual servers that contain cards for the corporation. So when the runner declares a run, they encounter in order any ice that's in front of that server. Or, I guess, yeah, in front of that server, defending that server. So, as I said, ice goes face down in front of a server and can be played. You can play 1, 2, 3 up in front of a server. And that, they're encountered in, I guess, God, it's hard to...
Like, visual order? You just sort of,
yeah.
That one is first and...
The one closest to the runner is the one encountered first. And
yeah, I mean, that basically makes sense.
Yep. And the runner, so, I guess ice has, I guess, going back to ice a little bit, ice has a cost to res the card, to flip it face up. It also has a strength, a number of card types, for instance, barrier or code gate or sentry. Those are the three main ones, but there's a lot of subtypes, kind of like creature types, as it were.
Mm-hmm.
And then they'll also have a number of subroutines on them, which are like the active action that an ice takes when encountered. So, again, for example, one of the most, like a very common in the core set piece of ice is just called Wall of Static. It costs 3 to flip face up, it has 3 strength, and has a single subroutine that just says end the run. And that subroutine, if that subroutine executes and goes off, it boots the runner out of the run, and that action is over. The runner, the idea there is that the runner has programs that will break the subroutine and allow them to continue the run to the next piece of ice, to the next piece of ice, to, you know, their eventual goal. Being 3 different major types of ice, there's 3 different major types of ice breakers that are programs that break barriers, programs that break code gates, programs that break sentries, and there are programs that break all types, though those are usually, you know, costed a bit higher. So the runner, every time that they run into a piece of an ice on a run, they have to use either let the ice do its thing or use a program that they control to bust through it and continue going. And that's, I guess that's the simple, oh man, simple run through on how that goes. When the runner makes it through past each piece of ice, they get to access whatever server they were running at. If they run at a remote server, they get to access any cards that are in it. And if there was an agenda, they get to take that. If they access the deck, they get to take look at the top card. If it's an agenda, they take that. Or if it has a trash cost, they can pay that and get rid of it, either off the deck or off the hand. And that's... There's a bit more, like, framework-wise to that, but that's the gist of a run as far as an action goes. It is the main, I guess, interactive point of the game is when those are occurring.
Yeah, because it sounds like there's not much in terms of I do a thing and then, well, I'll choose to do something else until you have this, like, I'm encountering your face down thing, do you flip it or not?
Right, and that's
moment.
That's the main, yeah, that is the very much the main interaction. It's the main, I guess, action that the runner is going to be taking, because their victory condition is to take 7 points from the corporation. If the runner sits there and does absolutely nothing, never does perform a run, they really can't win the game.
Okay, so I mean that's a way to establish inevitability for your game.
Yep.
Say, you know, you have to do this in order to ever win.
Yeah, there are alternate win conditions in the game. So if the corporation fails to draw a card, fails to draw a card out of their deck, they lose. But a byproduct of that is the if they've drawn their entire deck, all of their agendas have to be located in their hand or their graveyard. So generally the game ends much earlier than that.
Mm-hmm.
Because if the runner just runs at the graveyard and finds, oh, you discarded 4 points worth of agendas, I'll go ahead and take those. Thank you.
Jeez.
Yep.
So is there like a double trash zone like we have in Magic?
There is a single card I can think of that uses the term remove this card from the game. Because the card itself is a recursion piece. So scored agendas go into a scored agenda zone. It's just like this kind of non-zone that you can't interact with. But you can also, as I mentioned earlier, way earlier, you can use agendas as a cost to play. There's a couple quite powerful cards because you're giving up your victory condition to do so. And those go into, like, another remove from the game zone.
Hmm.
Yeah.
All right, that's a pretty good outline of the basics of how to play Netrunner.
Yeah, that's...
Of course, you've done a lot of tournament Netrunner.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
How does a Netrunner tournament go? Like, what additional steps do we need?
Okay, I guess the first additional thing that I should bring up is that there's one other, I guess, major piece that I've left out here.
Ah, okay.
And that is... That is that there are factions on both sides, and identity cards for the corporation or the runner that kind of define your deck or your deck style in a bit more. So a faction, so for the, I guess just quick going down them, the runner has 3 different factions, the corporation has 4. The runner has Anarch, Shaper, and Criminal. I bet you can guess which one I played. there are also neutral cards on each side. And then the corporation side has NBN, which is like a news conglomerate. Jinteki, which is about cloning. Haas Bioroid, which is about Bioroids, like synthetic life / And I guess the idea. And then the last corporation is Wayland, which is a flat alien reference.
They could just say Wayland.
Yeah, they could just say
like Wayland Yutani.
Wayland Yutani. Yeah. They're like the Eddie Energy Consortium.
Hmm. Okay, so when you're making your deck, you pick one of these?
Yes, you pick one of these, and you have an identity card for that faction. There are multiple different identity cards in each faction, and each of them has, I guess, looking at one, you would have the faction that they're in, the minimum deck size that's required of you, that actually varies based on identity.
Hmm.
You have a influence value, which is a number I haven't talked about on a card yet, but I'll get to that here. A quick on that is it's the amount of out-of-faction cards you can play in your deck.
Ah.
And then you have the ability of your identity, so...
Okay, so that's sort of like Hearthstone, where we have our, like, our person...
Yeah.
And
they have
cards
a thing
to them, and then there are neutral cards, too, that you can put in your deck. But if say, there were 2 different mages... Right?
Yeah,
you could
yeah.
use the same mage-specific cards, but had different hero powers,
yep. So,
for instance.
To give a quick on that, the criminal ones, the base game one is Gabriel Santiago, and his ability is on each turn, each time you make a successful run at your opponent's hand, you gain 2 credits. Which means you're, like, aggressively accessing your opponent's hand, you're making money more so than you would normally getting credits by doing so. And that kind of is, you know, shows your play style. Another criminal identity just says your starting hand size is 9 rather than 5.
Yo!
that it has no, you know, effect.
Like you've taken an extra turn at the beginning of the game where you just drew a bunch of cards?
Yeah, you drew 9 cards instead of 5. That's your only ability. Like, you don't have...
Right, right.
But it gives you a lot more consistency with your deck because you have 9 cards. So that kind of illustrating the difference, even in the same faction, you'll have... I think at this point in the game, there's, like, most factions have, like, 3 different identities and some have up to, like, 5.
Hmm.
So there's a lot of different... You know, there's not just the criminal deck. There's, you know, in criminal, there's 5 different identities that you can choose from. And even within those identities, there's a lot of different leeway you can go with because each identity has an influence value, which, so I guess quick going back, deck size is 45 cards is the, I won't say minimum because that's untrue, but it's the average.
Like the median deck size?
Yeah, like most identities have a 45 deck size on them. Some have 40. And then a 3 of each card limit rather than 4. So it's the same.
Okay, so the mode deck size then. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
I have to pick the correct of average.
Yes, that's a much better, that is a better word there. Because average would be like, yeah, anyway. Yeah, and 3x of a card. So the ratio is the same as Magic and Hearthstone, where Hearthstone is 2x of a card in 30, Magic is 4x of a card in 60, we have 3x of a card in 45, leaving that...
Okay, yeah, I think that Yu-Gi-Oh! Had that same... That must be a sweet spot, you know?
That, like, that ratio?
Yeah.
Yeah, that seems to be a common thing in games, and that's...
It's like games that... allow you to do more or less than that just sort of get ignored, or we dismiss them after a while as, yeah, this is junk, I don't get to play enough of what I want.
Yeah.
Man, there's probably like a doctoral thesis of game design somewhere out there about like why that ratio is a thing.
I wonder if Magic picked it arbitrarily. Like, I know Magic, because Magic, when it started, didn't have a deck size or a card.
I know, there. Yeah, no, there was a deck of 20 Mox Pearls, 20 Sherazades.
Yeah.
Or something.
20 Black Lotus, 20 Fireball, and some Wheel of Fortune.
20 Black Lotuses and 20 Playgrass.
Yeah,
that's real magic.
Real magic. But yeah.
So, yeah, okay. So it does have the ratio.
Yep. And
you have identities.
And So the identities have their minimum deck size, and they have an influence value, which is the amount of influence that they can pull from other factions. So each card...
Okay, so because I have, like, an influence of 3 as a criminal, then I could have 3 anarch cards in my deck?
A bit different. There's...
Okay.
I guess the base is 15 on that, but that one varies a lot more wildly.
Oh.
Each card in the bottom right has a number of pips ranging from 0 to 5, and those pips are its influence cost. So in order to, if you're playing a criminal and you want to pull a playset, 3 of, a card that costs 5 pips, that's 15 pips, and that's your entire influence for your deck.
I see.
So it's the way of...
I only wish it were as simple as I said.
No. No, every card has its own pip value, influence.
All right, so the pip value matters at deck construction time.
Only at deck construction.
All
there
right.
Is no card at least... that... There is no card that cares about in-game at
oh
the
my goodness.
Moment.
So I imagine... I imagine at getting back to tournament Netrunner...
Mm-hmm.
I imagine that there's some kind of deck check then, since we have these pretty, I mean, pretty complicated rules for what deck composition even can be.
The Netrunner events I've been to are, I guess, Worlds and Worlds was on a comparable scale to, like, a Magic event. It was about under 200, but, like, 150 some player event. And at that event, everybody had to bring in a deck list. So I guess going to the tournament structure, as you asked about, for a Netrunner tournament, you bring a deck of each side. You bring a runner and a corporation deck.
Okay, and at that time, you have your identity figured out and your deck constructed, and that's that.
Yep. So that's at that point, that's before the tournament, you've come up with this idea that you really like this identity that there's an identity called the Professor in Shaper that has one influence but can pull any number of programs from out of faction at a 1x. Cool idea with that. They get the Professor has his own deck construction rules. You built a deck around him, or there's a number of different 40 card identities or 10 influence or lower. Those vary wildly on cards. But you've built your deck, and you come to this event. You build a runner deck and a corporation deck. You fill out a deck list for both. And you give that to them. And a tournament in Netrunner generally consists of, let's say, 4 to 6 rounds of Swiss. So if you're familiar with a Magic event, that'll make sense. But not, I'll elaborate here. You'll play 4 to 6 rounds of continuous game that, even if you lose 1, 2, 3, you're not eliminated until the end of the rounds of Swiss, at which point they cut to a top 8 or a top 16 or a top 10.
Right, and in Swiss, you generally get matched up against people who share your record.
Yes.
So you kind of, you go through the different, like, brackets, as it were, or the, like...
Yeah, and with Netrunner, you show up, you build your deck, you look at the pairings, okay, you're paired against... this player here, you sit down and you play one game on each side. So you'll play two games, and that's a full match. And so you'll play one game as the runner, they'll play one as the corporation, then you'll switch, you'll play corporation, they'll play runner. And each match win is worth 2, like, points. So you can, if you sweep the match, you get 4 total points, I guess... To kind of elaborate on that, in Magic, like, a match win is worth 3 points in the tournament structure, a draw is worth 1, and a loss is worth 0. But in Netrunner, it's like, if you win both matches, you end up with 4, or you can just split and you both get 2. So it makes, like, the individual games matter a lot more than the full match. If you, in a tournament Magic setting, you play a best of 3, and if you lose one of your 3... that really doesn't affect you outside of tiebreakers or whatnot. But in a Netrunner tournament, each game means, 2 points on your record. So your record is, in the first round I won one game and lost another, in the second round I won both. So you have 6 total points at that point. And you get matched up against people with similar point totals to you. However, the tournament structure radically changes once you get to elimination, the reason being that you have a match is one game as one side, one game as another. Okay, well, what actually happens in a draw in an elimination setting? Well, that's still kind of up in the air. I mean that actually quite literally.
Man.
The tournament structure of Netrunner recently changed radically with regard to elimination rounds. It used to be that the agenda point total in games was the tiebreaker. So if you won a game 7-0 and your opponent won their game with 7 points, but you scored 3, those 3 points versus the opponent's 0 in the other game would be like the tiebreaker, and you would win the match even though you both won a game. They ended changing the tournament structure, though.
All right, so what is the current tournament structure?
It's much
for elimination rounds.
It's much closer to an esports tournament structure like Evo or something like that, where you have this double elimination bracket with a winner's bracket and a loser's bracket, where you play, instead of playing a match, you play a single game, and then if you win that game, you continue on in that bracket, and if you lose that game, you end up in the loser's bracket and keep playing through there. And if you lose two games, you're out. The idea being that if you've lost two games, you've lost one as the runner and one as the corp, though it's difficult to enforce that on a logistical level. But that's the basic idea, is that you're playing to two losses there. But that's a pretty recent change, and I've only had only played in two events under that structure, and those were both within the last month. So, very recent. Yeah. But yeah. And that's...
Do you think that you could structure a tournament such that you have players of only one deck? Like you have... This is a tournament of 20 runners and 20 corporations.
That would be an interesting tournament. Like, you show up with one deck or the other, and then right. The idea is you come out on the top of... Yes, I think you could structure that way. And that would that would be... I mean, you would have to... At that point, it would be like a Magic tournament, but there's only one side of players you could play against, because a runner could
right.
play against each other, and a corp can't
yeah,
play
so I guess in that sense, it's really cutting the tournament pool in half,
yeah.
And it would be more a kind of oddity for the sake of showing how different this game can be to other collectible card games.
Yeah, that's actually a really good point to bring up, is one of the... This actually... Fantasy Flight doesn't brand this game as a collectible card game. They actually have their own term for it.
Oh.
It is a living card game, which is their term for... rather than the game being sold in booster packs, the game is sold in these small expansions that come out... I say periodically. It should be every month, but that schedule...
Good lord, every month?
Well, every month, when I say small, I mean it's a very small, like a kind of like a small board game expansion, like an expansion for Munchkin, or like Flux, or one of those kind of games, that contains 20 different cards and a full playset of those 20 cards. So 60 cards total. And those are generally spread between the seven factions pretty equally.
All right, and these are new cards?
New cards.
Every month?
I say every month, and that's the intended schedule, but it ends up being a bit farther apart than that.
I don't think I could deal with new cards every single month.
It's
man.
But the
I guess it's a smaller array of them, so that's...
Right, it's only... It being 20 cards, it ends up being about 2 to 3 cards per faction. And they end up releasing them in these... packs of 6 that make up a cycle, or basically a set. So 120 cards to a full, like, set equivalent. And those just get it's like a set being released very gradually over 6 months.
Oh, okay. Well, I guess that's okay.
Yeah, but the idea there is that there's no hunting for cards. There's no, I need to go buy myself a playset of Jace the Mind Sculptor so I can play Legacy. Like, each of these cards are a known value in a small expansion. Like, those 20 cards are set. They're not random in any way. So there's no...
Okay, so the collectible aspect is kind of gone, and you're closer to a Munchkin or Flux.
Yeah, so if there's, you know, if you're getting into the game, right now there's 2 full sets of packs, so 2 sets of 120. The core set, which is kind of the best way to get into it, and then there's these 2 deluxe expansions that only focus on they're like one corp and one runner in that expansion, and each side gets about 30 new cards.
Hmm. So, for sets in legality, is there just like one? This is tournament Netrunner, and there's one list of
it is
cards for it.
All cards at this point, because
okay, so we don't have any bannings or restrictions.
There
yet?
Is absolutely there is no restrictions, no bannings at the moment. There are at the moment of this being recorded. in the future,
at this very second,
yeah, it might change. but at the moment, there's two full sets of 120 cards, two deluxe expansions, which are each 55 cards. So that's another 110. So that's 350 plus the core set, which is about 120 unique cards. So the whole format as a whole only has 450 unique cards. But because of kind of how the release works, they don't have to, you don't have to have cards that are designed for limited, cards that are designed for like a weird bad purpose, like Magic kind
right,
of.
Right. It's like there's one tournament structure and one set or what do you call it?
Format.
Format.
There is a draft format that exists. I have not yet played it. It's strange because the allure of a draft, part of it is to, get new cards if I'm playing a draft in real life at a store. But in Netrunner, like, you've bought this expansion, you own a playset of this card. Why do I need to draft to get more of this playset of card I own? That sort of thing. So I've yet to play in a draft yet, but the format exists. It's not even like a tournament format at the moment.
All right, well, that's a great overview of the game, how it goes in tournaments. What would you say to... I do believe... I'm going to go ahead and say this for you. I do believe that you want more people to play Netrunner.
Yeah, I currently... I've been trying to get more people to play at our local store. I started kind of running a scene and found that we actually have a number of players in town, and we have like a dozen players at the moment.
So what would you say is the best reason to get into Netrunner?
One of the big things in the game is the two biggest we'll go with. The first is that there's a lot more decision put into it compared to a game like Magic or Hearthstone. When you're playing Magic and Hearthstone, a lot of the times the decision points you have are either binary or, they're a known quantity of decisions that you have. Do I play this two drop or this two drop?
Right. You can very rapidly assess the board state or whatever and determine what the best thing to do is and then do that thing.
Whereas with Netrunner, because your turn is made up of four actions of your choice, you end up having a lot more. You come up with, rather than coming up with an action to take, or you come up with like a strategy to follow and kind of play to that, and you can very easily change it on the fly. Go, okay, well, I was trying to access cards from your deck. You aren't allowing that in the slightest. Let's completely change gears. We'll move to something else. Because you have the ability to draw, you can draw cards at any point, you can play any cards from your hand, you can get money, you can use the abilities on cards you control. At any one point in the game, your number of decisions is a lot higher than Magic.
Hmm.
Which means, like, there's a bit more complexity in the decisions you're making, but there's a lot more options available to you. In Magic, a lot of the times, I've played a number of games where I feel like the game played itself. I drew my 2-drop, 3-drop, 4-drop, 5-drop in succession. I didn't actually make a choice there. I just went and played those. Whereas in Netrunner, I don't think I've ever played a game that felt like I didn't make a decision during the game. And the other half of that is the hidden information side gives it a very heavy bluffing aspect to the game, where you can be playing the player a lot of the times. Like, okay, he has an ice down in front of his deck. He only has 4 credits. Okay, what could that possibly be? Okay, great. Well, or he has a card that has, he played a card in a remote server and advanced it twice. And, you can advance an agenda, but there's also traps. They're a type of assets or upgrades that, you know, have a negative effect if accessed, that look exactly the same as an agenda if played face down and advanced. So, you know, is your opponent playing mind games with you? Are they actually trying to score that? Do they know that you can actually get in there and take that? And you know, they know that
okay,
you have
so
resources. There's a bluff.
If you like cyberpunk, mm-hmm. dystopian futures, and you like Criminal Activity, and you like card game complexity, or at least card game decision making.
Yeah, if you want to feel like you have, if you feel like you have control of what you're doing.
And games with hidden information, then I guess that Netrunner would be the game for you, and you should go give it a shot.
Yeah. Any other things you'd like to?
If there was anything that you would change about the game, either in like fundamental structure or the tournament, the way tournaments are run, or like an individual card that is just apostasy and should be changed, what would you change?
There are a couple cards that, let's put it lightly, are head and shoulders above other cards as far as like quality goes that might want some changes. There are influence costs on cards that are a bit too small. But those are like just kind of minor grr sort of things. If I were going to make a larger change to the game, I would specifically change how the core set was put out. For some reason, the core set has, it's the, you know, the first thing that was put out. It's, if you're getting into the game, that's what you buy. But the core set contains two ofs and one ofs of cards, and that's, for a game about building your deck and having all options available to you, is frustrating at times.
So you have to go buy three core set boxes?
If you want a play set of every card that exists, yes. That would be number one on my list of...
Okay.
Fantasy Flight has been releasing promo cards with alternate art that's been filling that void pretty easily, but... It takes time to actually get all of those to exist.
Well, without ever having played it, really, and this is the first large
introduction
description, and this is my introduction to the game too. I can already say that I like it for not having a like for what it lacks, for not having mana screw. Basically,
yeah, I have
your resources are very direct.
It
if
is
you,
yeah.
You want money, you get it.
Yeah, you're out of cards, go draw some. You're out of, you know, you don't have a way to play cards, get your money. You know, you can, there's almost always avenues available too. It's very hard to come into a game state where the game is over. You know, you just kind of have to shift gears. Like, oh no, I can't get cards out of his hand, I'll go for his deck. I can't get into his deck, I'll go for cards he plays and play, etc. So there's a lot of, you know, the mana screw mana flood thing doesn't happen. So.
Okay, so one last thing.
Mm-hmm.
In your tenure as a player of Netrunner, what was your favorite moment, your favorite play, or even something like slightly outside the game that just happened incidentally?
I know this one, yes. Okay, when I first started playing, I started playing with a roommate of mine at the time, Walker, and me and him played a lot, initially with both the core set, and at that point it was only one small expansion, the card pool was very small, and he had built a new deck, and we had played maybe two games against it, and there was a point in the third game where he plays, you know, he plays a piece of ice face down protecting his deck. And I'm like, okay, I will run on your Data Raven. And I just call the name of the card out without having seen it. And he flips it up and he's like, how did you know that? I'm like, yeah, don't worry about that. And he plays another piece of ice in front of his hand. And I'm like, I'll run on your Matrix Analyzer. He's like, no, you did. How did you know that? I'm like, yeah, don't worry. And then he plays another one on a remote server, and I'm like, okay, I'll run on your other Data Raven. He's like, no, you can't know that. And he ended up conceding the game after the fourth one I called out because I defeated the player rather than... And the trick there being that I was continuously accessing the top card of his deck. So I knew the cards he was drawing in the order he drew them. And, you know, he would very obviously play them. But it was the most hilarious moment I had, defeating the player and not the... Defeating the player, not the opponent. I love that.
Right. Man, I don't... Honestly, I don't think I've ever quite accomplished that feat. No, okay, there was one, but that's my story and for another time having to do with something else. I do know the feeling. I'll leave it at that.
Okay, that's good.
Well, thanks a bunch for joining me. This has been great. I think Netrunner is a fine game. Again, having never played it exactly, but it checks a lot of the right boxes for fun, interactive multiplayer experiences in my mind.
Yeah, as the world champion, I do enjoy it. I really, really like the game.
That's pretty good too. I mean, it'd be a shame. It's like, yeah, well, I'm the human who's best at this, but
yeah. I'm like the world champion, but the game's like okay, I suppose.
I guess it's okay.
Yeah, but yeah, that's. I've actually been having a lot of fun playing it. Oh, like it's gotten me out of constructed magic for the most part at this point. So. Yeah, it's good.
Okay, I'm sure your wallet thanks you for that one.
It really does. I don't need to go hunt down a playset of Tarmogoyf or Mutavault, something like that. Whatever the current tournament staple and standard is. Mutavault's probably that. But yeah. So, any other thoughts on it?
No, that's really all I had. So again, thanks a bunch for joining me.
Okay.
And skulls.